May it please the court and the counsel. Good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Moran. I'm representing the defendant appellant, Dr. James Walter. With me in the audience is Amy Cardone, who together with John Conklin represented Dr. Walter in the trial court. As the court has already noted, we have two appeals here today on this case.
Excuse me, counsel. Pardon me for interrupting you, but do we have something wrong with the microphones there?
It's echoing.
It's echoing and it's causing a
feedback.
Feedback, right?
Yeah, we're hearing. Yeah, we're hearing counsel through our speakers up here, which we ordinarily don't.
It's a little distracting.
I hear myself twice or three times.
Let's try it.
May it please the court?
That sounds better. I can hear you. I can hear you fine. Can you hear counsel?
And I'm not getting feedback.
Okay.
Is your speak light? Mine, I'm not talking and it's on my microphone.
Okay. All right. Sorry, Ms. Moran.
As I mentioned, there are two appeals from this case. The case, the claims against Dr. Walter and the claims by the plaintiff against Pinnacle were tried together in one trial in Denver District Court. Our part of the case concerns the medical negligence claim by plaintiff against Dr. Walter. This arose out of a spinal cord or spinal surgery that Dr. Walter performed on the plaintiff to treat his neck problem stemming from an earlier injury. The surgery was an anterior cervical disc infusion, which basically involved removing herniated disc material from two levels and then fusing the spine. After the surgery, the plaintiff had some symptoms of pain and hypersensitivity, first in his left arm and then later at various places on his right side, along with weakness, which he claimed continued to the present day. After surgery, a postoperative MRI did show an increased area of signal intensity at the C5 to C6 level of the spine. The significance of that and the relationship of that to his symptoms after surgery was the subject of disputed evidence at trial, as were the issues of negligence, causation, and the extent of damages generally. The two issues that we have raised in this appeal, the first one relates to the trial court's refusal to give the pattern CJI 15:4 bad outcome instruction. And the second has to do with the trial court's allowing plaintiff's expert neurologist, Dr. Woodcock, to express an untimely causation and damages opinion at trial. And I'm going to talk first about the instructional issue. Dr. Walter, at the during trial, tendered the standard instruction based on CJI 15:4 as follows. As to plaintiff's medical negligence claim, a physician does not guarantee or promise a successful outcome by simply treating or agreeing to treat a patient. An unsuccessful outcome does not by itself mean that a physician was negligent. Now, the standard instruction also includes a third sentence regarding an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome. However, at the time of this trial, that very issue, that language, the exercise of judgment language, was before the Supreme Court in the Day versus Johnson case. And so to avoid getting into problems with having that language in there, the tendered instruction merely said an unsuccessful outcome is not evidence of negligence. In fact, that instruction that was tendered is identical to the one that was stipulated to by the plaintiffs in the Day case. So it was basically the same instruction. Just a few words about this court's review of the instructional issue. The trial court is obligated to correctly instruct the jury on the law governing the case. And this court reviews de novo whether a particular instruction correctly states the law, and also whether the instructions as a whole adequately inform the jury of the law governing the case.
Also, we review for an abuse of discretion whether to give a particular instruction, and that's your argument here.
Actually, my argument is that before you get to the discretionary review, you have to determine that the instructions correctly adequately advise the jury of the law governing the case. If they did, then issues of form, style, and whether to give or not to give a particular instruction are discretionary. But I think for initially the court has to review it, whether the jury was instructed properly on all the law that governed the case. And here I believe they were not, because the bad outcome principle is a fundamental tenet of tort law that is absolutely essential to a medical negligence case. Now, this instruction, the 15-4 instruction, is based on case law that goes back to the early 1900s, back to the case of Bonnet versus Foote in about 1910. And as early as 1912, the Court of Appeals determined that it was prejudicial error not to give an instruction that advised the jury of this principle. What the court emphasized in that case is, in judging medical negligence, what the jury needs to do is look at what the defendant did or didn't do and whether that was reasonable in comparison to what reasonable physicians of similar specialties do or don't do. What the jury is not to be guided by in determining negligence is the outcome of the case. The criterion of results is the way the court phrased it. The court stated that the reason the instruction is necessary is because the jury's attention on the negligence issue, which is often a decisive issue in the case, needs to be confined to what is competent evidence on the issue of negligence by telling them also what is not competent evidence on the issue of negligence.
Could you tell us what the trial court's reason for not giving this instruction was?
The reason, and this wasn't discussed at length, there was a jury instruction conference off the record the day before instructions and closing arguments were given, and the court's reasoning was that this wasn't an unsuccessful outcome case because the surgery was successful in treating the neck problem, even though it caused a different problem. And that appears in the record the following morning during the record on instructions where I believe counsel for plaintiff summarized that as the court's position, and that was what had occurred, was that the court had determined this, it wasn't appropriate because it wasn't an unsuccessful outcome. Yet all the experts in the case agreed that this was an unsuccessful outcome for the very reason that even though the discs surgery was successful in treating the herniated disc, it had caused a separate complication of a nerve injury.
So, for example, if this had been an informed consent case where the physician had operated on the wrong appendage, we would not have a bad outcome kind of instruction, or would we?
In a operating on the wrong limb type of a case, you know, that would then present a question of, is it a res ipsa loquitur case, where negligence can be inferred from the injury itself. That's the only time that this instruction, I believe, is not proper, is when the circumstances are such that from the very fact of injury, negligence can be inferred. And that, by definition, is a res ipsa loquitur case. You know, there are cases that say that when a res ipsa instruction is given, you should not give this bad outcome instruction because they're two sides, they're opposite sides of the same principle. But here, and in the vast majority of medical negligence cases, injury cannot be inferred, or negligence cannot be inferred from the mere fact of injury. Rather, negligence must be proven by showing that the physician did or did not do something that a reasonable physician would do. The McGraw court ended by saying that because this instruction is legally correct and it's applicable to a material issue in the case, the issue of negligence, it's reversible error not to give it. It's still a correct statement of the law. Most recently, it's been addressed in the Day versus Johnson case, both by a panel of this court and then by the Colorado Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals characterized the principle behind this instruction as a fundamental tenet of tort law. The mere fact that a plaintiff has suffered injury without more doesn't mean a defendant is negligent. The Supreme Court, I'm sorry.
So are you saying that based upon McGraw, because this is a legally correct statement of the law, that we would have to reverse if we agree with that without considering prejudice to the defendant, to your client?
Well, I think prejudice is something that does need to be considered to find reversible error, but as the McGraw court explained, because the negligence determination focuses not on the outcome, and you can't infer negligence from the outcome, the failure to give this instruction is reversible error. Because it is prejudicial, it tends to mislead the jury into thinking they can infer negligence from something they cannot infer negligence from, and that's the outcome.
How is the jury misled by the failure to give an instruction? What is it that misleads the jury?
The jury is misled in general, and then I'll talk about in this case in particular. The jury is misled because it, without this instruction, it doesn't understand what all it can consider properly in determining negligence. The negligence instruction says you look at what, did the physician do what a reasonable surgeon would do? But the jury can look at that and say, well, a reasonable surgeon wouldn't cause an injury, so the plaintiff was injured, therefore I can infer negligence. What this instruction does is directs the jury's attention away from the results from which it cannot infer negligence to look at the actual conduct of the defendant. And I think the court in McGraw explains that very well, is for the jury to know what is competent evidence of negligence, they have to also know what is not competent evidence of negligence, the outcome.
Better if the argument of counsel, plaintiff's counsel in this case, said we have to prove beyond the fact of the bad outcome that the defendant was negligent, would that cure any prejudice in such a case?
I think it would help, but an argument is not an instruction on the law, and this is the law. The bad outcome principle is the law in Colorado. A jury can reject an argument. A jury cannot reject a jury instruction. And I think that what comes out of the Day case, and even the Supreme Court's opinion as well, is that this is a very essential element of a medical malpractice case. Although Day really focused mostly on the exercise of judgment portion of the instruction, the court also did talk at length about the outcome aspect and characterized it as being part of our modern medical malpractice jurisprudence and a long-standing tenet of tort and medical malpractice law that the jury may not infer negligence from the fact of injury. Now, in this case, I think it was particularly important that a jury receive this instruction, not only because it's kind of a gut reaction of lay jurors that, if somebody has surgery and they don't get better, and in fact they get another injury, something went wrong. Something wasn't done right. But in this case, it was also presented through the testimony of the plaintiff's expert witness, and particularly in closing argument at trial. It was suggested to the jury that they could infer negligence from the fact that the plaintiff was injured at the location where the doctor was operating. The argument was made that this is like when a carpenter is hammering and knocks a hole in a wall, or somebody's driving down the street and gets in an accident. If they cause an injury, they're legally responsible to the plaintiff, because if you cause an injury, you're responsible. I think to focus the jury back on the actual need to find negligent conduct, this instruction was particularly needed in this case. I think also the fact that the trial court has the overarching obligation to make sure that the jury is instructed on all pertinent points of law, and also that a party is entitled to his theory of the case instruction if it's supported by evidence, that those indicate that it's error not to give this instruction, which is very important not only in this medical malpractice case, but in almost all medical malpractice cases. So for those reasons, we would ask the court to find, as the court did many years ago in the McGraw case, that it's prejudicial error not to give this instruction where it's applicable to the evidence and where it correctly states the law, as it certainly did in this case. Okay, next, I have 30 seconds remaining. I would, with respect to the argument about Dr. Woodcock, I'd simply incorporate the arguments made in our briefs, and I'll reserve about 27 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. This makes me really nervous. As you know, this is a Carison rongeur. This is what's used by a surgeon when they're decompressing the spine. It's a hand tool, has a little bit of kick to it because it's spring-loaded, and it's used, you know, they have to stabilize it when they're trying to remove disc material. And what I brought with me today is that one of the demonstrative exhibits that we used at trial, which was the actual MRI from Mr. Schuessler's spine the day following his surgery. And it's been colorized to show you the lesion. Up in the upper right-hand corner is what the MRI actually looks like, and then it's been enhanced by a graphics company. So that lesion existed after the surgery, but not before. The evidence that came in at trial, we believe, showed overwhelmingly that the cause of this lesion in Mr. Schuessler's spinal cord was the surgical technique of the surgeon, Dr. Walter, which was substandard technique, and then he somehow used this tool and punched it against the spinal cord, and that's what caused the injury. So we disagree with Dr. Walter that the instruction about that just because you have an injury during a surgery doesn't mean the doctor was negligent is a presumption. We don't disagree that it's a tenet of tort law that the presumption of an accident and injuries is not presumption of negligence. And I think that's what the Supreme Court evaluated when they looked at this instruction in the Day case, that it's a presumption. It's not a error in judgment, it's a presumption against negligence, similar to the instruction that we have under the negligence instructions, which is that the happening of an accident is not presumption of negligence. That's CJI 9:12. So from our standpoint, the analysis really falls under the most recent case of the Supreme Court under Kruger versus Ari, which is this 2009 decision that talks about presumption and how presumptions are to be treated. So if the presumption is that there's an injury from a surgery, that it's not evidence of negligence, if the plaintiff overcomes that presumption, the presumption drops out. That's what the Supreme Court has said. And then we go forward from there. And then what drops in are the standards on negligence for how a surgeon is to be held responsible.
So the trial court didn't rely on that rationale at all, did it?
But, you know, and I want to point this out to you as well. I don't think there's a clear ruling in the record from the trial court. There was a jury instruction conference the night before jury instructions were given. We probably spent at least an hour, maybe more, going over the instructions and the debates. That wasn't on the record. And the next day, the judge gave us time to make our record concerning our tendered instructions, and it was just simply rejected. I looked at the record that Ms. Moran cited to in her brief, and it says, you know, Ms. Bissett. And actually, I think that it was Ms. Cardone who was stating a position on CJI 15-4. It wasn't me. I didn't address those arguments on negligence because I had primary responsibility in the bad faith case. So it's not clear what the judge did here.
Well, no one corrected that statement. The trial court certainly didn't.
In terms of, I'm not
saying that's not the basis for my ruling, for example.
There's really nothing in here that gives us much guidance on it other than it was, tendered and refused.
But your argument seems to be that this instruction, if given, is simply a presumption instruction.
It is. That is my position.
And if, but I don't see any evidence in the record that I reviewed that says that that issue was brought forth as a basis to say to the trial court, here's why you don't have to give it.
Was in our brief. But you're right, Your Honor. You know, there isn't anything in the record on the discussion on this that was rejected. And I think there's another rationale for it, which is that Mr. Schuster had a herniated disc in his neck. He had a two-level fusion. There was a decompression. So the decompression and the fusion actually took care of the injury that he had walking into the surgery. It decompressed the nerve roots, and there was a successful fusion. But what was not contemplated was this result. And there was some discussion in the record about consent, and the judge clearly instructed the jury that you don't consent to a surgeon's negligence. So I brought that with me today, too. Let's see. I get nervous, and then I start losing my place.
So I want to go back to this idea that you're offering that this is somehow a presumption instruction. What case says that? I mean, I'm looking at the language in the instruction. It doesn't sound like a presumption instruction.
I think what they talk about in the Day case is that the fact that you have an injury following a surgery isn't a presumption of negligence on the part of the surgeon. You still have to go forward and prove your case of negligence.
Isn't a presumption. Exactly. It isn't a presumption.
I'm sorry, but if I misspoke, I think that that's how I interpreted the Day case.
But it's not instructing the jury to presume anything.
Well, I think it is.
How? Explain that.
Well, let's look at the stock instruction.
It's telling them not to presume something.
Right. So I don't think it's a complete defense, but let's take a look at the opposite. Could the plaintiff say, you know, that there's a presumption of negligence because an injury happened? No. Can they say that there's a presumption of no negligence because an injury happened? Well, it's a presumption, but it's a rebuttable presumption.
Well, it's not really a presumption. It's that the court, and through such an instruction, is simply pointing out what evidence may be relevant to determining whether the duty was breached and what evidence is not, and that the mere fact of an injury is not evidence that the duty was breached.
Well, I think it's the same as this 912. The occurrence of an accident does not raise any presumption of negligence on the part of either the plaintiff or the defendant. So it's the same thing. The occurrence of an injury doesn't raise a presumption of negligence on the part of the surgeon.
Exactly. Doesn't raise a presumption. So how is an instruction telling a jury that something doesn't raise a presumption telling them that they should make a presumption?
I'm a little flustered, so I'm having trouble answering your question. I think it's a presumption. The presumption is that an injury did not occur.
Let's assume it was a presumption instruction. Why aren't they entitled to it? I mean, under the law, if the evidence supports the instruction, they're entitled to it. So you don't say, well, but our case was really strong. That's not really how it works.
I don't think it's a mandatory instruction, and I think that the Supreme Court addressed that in the Day decision, that it's not a mandatory instruction. It's not a mandatory instruction, and it's up to the discretion of the trial court to decide whether to give it or not.
But what guides that discretion? The court can't, if the court arbitrarily does it, just disregards it or refuses to give it, that's not a sound exercise of discretion. There has to be some standard. So when, in your view, must the court give such an instruction?
I think that, you know, it kind of boils down to what caused the result. So is the result that you got the result of substandard care, or is it something that the physician didn't have control over?
But that's for the jury to decide. That's not for the court to rule on in deciding what instructions to give. That's a jury question.
Well, but I disagree, Judge, and I don't mean to be difficult here. I'm here to argue, so I guess I'm going to argue with you, but that's not how I read this Kruger decision. The Kruger decision talks about rebuttable presumptions have a limited purpose.
But Kruger didn't involve this instruction or
it
anything.
Did not.
Or that instruction is not worded anything like this one is. It really is a rebuttable presumption instruction.
Right.
In other words, it's an instruction that shifts the burden of proof. That's what a presumption instruction does. But this instruction just doesn't do that.
All right. Let's see what they said in... to talk about the burden of proof in a medical negligence claim is it's more than proving a bad outcome. You have to prove a breach of the applicable standard of care. You have to establish a breach of the duty of care in a medical malpractice case by showing that the defendant failed to conform to the standard of care ordinarily possessed and exercised by members of the same school of medicine practiced by the defendant, whether a reasonably careful surgeon in the same school would have acted in the same manner. That's the burden of proof. They talk about an exercise of judgment that results in an unsuccessful outcome is invokes the longstanding tenet of tort and medical malpractice that a jury may not infer negligence from the fact of injury. So what's the difference between an inference and a rebuttable presumption?
Thank you, I will. A rebuttable presumption shifts the burden of proof. Okay, an instruction like the one we're talking about here merely tells the jury what evidence is evidence of negligence and what evidence is not. Okay. It is not telling the jury which party bears the burden and what that burden is. That's a rebuttable presumption instruction.
Okay, so you don't think this is a rebuttable presumption instruction?
No, and I don't think any court has said that it is.
So, you know, when it's an inference,
it's not an inference. It's just saying you jury shall not infer negligence merely because there's an injury.
Okay.
All right.
So then the question becomes, does it become more complicated and confusing for the jury when you have in part a successful result and you have an injury caused by the surgeon? Because this isn't just a bad outcome. This is the surgeon actually caused an injury during the procedure. It's not the same. You know, you can have a bad outcome because somebody got a blood clot, somebody had swelling on the spinal cord, there was an infarct of some type. Those were the differential diagnosis that we went over in testimony with expert witnesses, and they ruled all that out. The only cause here was mechanical trauma to this spinal cord by the use of this instrument.
Even accepting all that, even accepting the evidence that you put on being substantial evidence of the doctor's negligence. The question is, what is the jury to do with the mere fact of a bad outcome? And if the jury said, and I guess it appears that you argued, Mr. Goodman argued, that the mere fact that he had an injury as a result of the surgery was enough by itself. And so he seemed to be arguing for a result of liability only because of the accident, of the incident itself, only because of the bad outcome. So
I think
all of us understand that the evidence you presented was significant on negligence. That's not the issue. I guess the issue is, what could the jury consider in deciding that negligence issue? And this instruction that they asked for simply said you can't infer merely because there's a bad outcome that there was negligence.
Well, is there potential for confusion when there's in part a successful outcome and an unsuccessful, or an injury that occurred during surgery at the hands of the surgeon?
So,
but you know, let me back up. I don't think that it's a mandatory instruction. Under the Davey decision, they talk about, at least in the footnotes, that it's a may instruction. They talk about it in footnote number 6. It may be given. I think it's a discretionary instruction. And so we go back to Ms. Moran's, you know, initial argument, which is, did the instructions as a whole instruct the jury on how to decide the case? And there's a couple of fundamental instructions. There's the negligence, the caring instruction, and the verdict form. Talking about, you know, what's the standard for a surgeon, you have to find negligence, and then you move on to the verdict form. So in totality, the judge gave the bare minimum of the instructions that were necessary to inform the jury as to how they should go about making their decision in this case.
Do we know from the dates, for example, whether that situation the jury also received those kinds of instructions? Because if the court in Day is saying this instruction should be given, and the jury also got the standard of care instructions and the other instructions you're talking about, doesn't that cut against your position?
I don't think so, because I think my position is if they're instructed on negligence, the standard of care, and they're given a proper verdict form that they're properly instructed. You know, they can offer their theory of the case in 2:1. You know, they offered a very nominal theory of the case in 2:1. Did they argue it? Sure, they argued it on opening and they argued it in closing. Same thing. You can't infer negligence because, you know, there's been an injury during surgery, although they call it a complication. I would like to just take one moment on the issues on Dr. Woodcock. Dr. Woodcock, we supplied his initial opinion with our initial disclosures in October 2009. We again tendered them in April of 2009. The defendants both delayed in getting a second opinion. They got a second opinion from Dr. Fall. Her opinion came out on, they sent us her opinion on June 24th. We had a trial date, which was August 23rd. And within 20 days, we gave them a rebuttal opinion from Dr. Woodcock. They haven't shown prejudice that Dr. Woodcock just specifically identified where this lesion was in the spinal cord. It was an anatomical issue. That's what they took exception to. I'm out of time.
Thank you.
I don't have any further comments unless the court has a question for me. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. And as soon as counsel for Pinnacle can be prepared and ready to go, we'll hear that appeal.